I'm Pete Hammond.
And I'm Dominic Hatt.
And this is the Deadline Podcast TV Talk.
Today we'll be discussing some of the biggest Emmy losers over the year, along with some of the contenders for Best Actress in a limited series or movie. Plus, you'll also hear some interviews done from our annual Deadline Emmys Contender event with the cast and creators of The Late Late Show with James Corden and WGN's now-canceled Underground. Why do you laugh?
We're just
going to start with funny. You laugh because I'm sure that you, of all people, you, the awards man, the editor, Deadline's awards editor, do not really like discussing people who have never actually won an Emmy.
I love talking about people that haven't won an Emmy. I mean, my God, you know, look, Susan Lucci made not winning an Emmy famous, let's face it.
I think she made it cool.
Yeah, well, you know, 19 times. And she never won, and it made her career bigger for not winning. That's fine. We know her as that. But, you know, of those who haven't won the Emmy, I think of people like Jackie Gleason in the Golden
Era. I can't get
era.
Over that one.
You know, he
I
never
can't get over that
won
one.
An Emmy, you know, and The Honeymooners was only on for one season, believe it or not.
You know,
not.
People don't believe me when I tell them that.
Yeah, but
they're like, oh, no, there were like 1,000 episodes.
No, you just watch it over and over.
No, you just think that because you're
and,
Alice.
And then he did it on his variety show, too. And, you know, and he never won for that. That just astounded me. People like
Angela.
Angela Lansbury.
Never won.
Murder, She Wrote. She was nominated every single year, but it's not the kind of thing that plays on the, you know, when you would watch the tape of the show that they'd submit. It was pretty much a consistent character week in and week out, and not one with a
sort
flashy
of like how it's
role.
Consistent week in, week out, that we are really plugging that Jackie Gleason and Angela should be getting well, some sort of honorary.
Somebody give Angela Lansbury. Yeah. Like, they gave her an honorary Oscar, maybe an honorary Emmy or something. It seems odd. But what about these people now in contemporary
times?
Okay,
well, for one thing, I mean, let's go through a list of some people who you might be surprised to learn have never actually won an Emmy.
Never won.
Steve Carell. Hugh Laurie, which actually, I actually had to go check that because I was like, that's wrong. There's a House Emmy in there somewhere for him.
He won Golden Globes and things.
You were right. Yeah. Bill Maher, which, whatever. Jerry Seinfeld, which right. I'm like, eh.
I have to put an asterisk on the last two. Bill Maher has won an Emmy, and so has Jerry Seinfeld.
You mean for writing?
For being producers of the show. The Seinfeld won Best Comedy Series. Jerry was a producer, so he got a physical Emmy. He never won personally himself. Now, Bill Maher, we know, has lost Emmy's Biggest Loser 23, 24 times. You know, between Politically Incorrect and his current show. He finally won 2 years ago, but he won't even acknowledge it for Vice, the show that he is a producer on.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I get that. I mean, I think you get your name attached to something. I mean, you know, Eileen Chaikin, who is the showrunner and one of the executive producers of Empire, is an executive producer, for instance, on Hulu's The Handmaid's Tale, right?
Yeah.
She worked on the project and then moved on to Empire and other people got involved. If Handmaid's Tale win, I mean, Eileen gets an Emmy. I mean, she does. But I don't think, you know, I don't think that even she would particularly chalk that up in her trophy cabinet.
No, and it's like, and Jerry Seinfeld never got it. And one of the TV's great comedians never got it. I mean, he only got it because he was attached on as a producer. That was going to happen, by the way, with Jon Hamm. He finally got wise and said, well, Mad Men wins every year as a producer. So the first 4 years, he was not a producer on the show. Season 5, he went, his agents renegotiated the thing, produced by Jon Hamm, among other people. And what happens? It's the first year Mad Men does not win an Emmy there. But he finally won, and this is a theory that you have espoused many times on this show, for final seasons, the final thing. Jon Hamm finally came in.
I'm a big believer in the Academy's sentimentality for final seasons.
I think in that case, you're absolutely right. It was so clear. This was their last chance to do it with Jon Hamm, and he finally won. But he not only had 7 or 8 consistent nominations for Mad Men, but he also had them for comedy work on 30 Rock and Saturday Night Live and things like that. And he never won any of those, too. So he might have been right in this category, too. I'm looking at Kevin Spacey, a guy who's won Tonys, who's won Oscars. Might be harder to win those, you'd think. He can't win an Emmy for the life of him.
I think Spacey's in a weird position because Spacey, I mean, it feels like it's so long ago, but it's unbelievable to remember that House of Cards debuted in 2013.
Yeah, I know.
It was the first really big name, big deal project, Netflix original programming. Yeah. Now it almost feels like, hasn't that solar system been around forever, right?
Yeah.
It's like Sputnik, just orbiting in some ways, right?
Exactly.
I feel like maybe his I hate to say this because actually I think the latest season of House of Cards is actually, it's got its swagger back again, to quote my own review, but for season 5. But I just feel like maybe the world has passed by.
Kevin Spacey?
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, maybe he has to do what a lot of actors do when they don't win Oscars or don't have that role. They come up with the role that's going to win because sometimes it's the role.
Frank Underwood should have been the role. That's the thing.
But I think you're right. I think it's time has passed for Kevin in terms of that. I don't know. I mean, look at what he's up against every year. There's always somebody that comes along and wins this thing.
Well, this is the thing, too. I actually do think that there's some people I think there are a lot of people, and I think we should be aware of this. I think there are a lot of Emmy voters and a lot of people. You take Kevin Spacey for granted.
Right.
They're just assuming, oh, Kevin Spacey's on. It's going to be great. Oh, but look at this new young thing that's come along. They're great, and they're doing this thing, and they're doing it with hula hoops. Like, and Kevin Spacey's just being incredibly insightful, incredibly rocketed. And another person who's also a producer on House of Cards, so also a double dip like that. To go back, though, to someone who hasn't won, who I really think should have won many times already, but I think is well-placed to win, and this is kind of part of my final season theory, is Kerry Russell for The Americans.
Okay.
Now, The Americans has just finished its penultimate season,
and
will be going into its sixth and final season next year. I think Kerry is a contender now. She got nominated last year, right? Finally. So did Matthew, by the way.
Yeah.
Finally. There's a big contender this year, and I think could be an even bigger contender final season. I really do think there is something to this final season thing. Because I think in a way, sometimes for the Academy, and I think shame on them on one level, it's acknowledging someone who you haven't acknowledged before in a way that's harmless to you because you kind of just get them out of the way.
Well, like we talked about on last week's episode, there are some shiny new objects there that are in the way of Kerry Russell for your theory here, and that would be Claire Foy and Elizabeth Moss, who are going to shake up the race, no question. And Elizabeth Moss, ironically, will be one who was nominated over and over and never won for Mad Men, finally get her due here, you know, so go figure.
All right, well, whoever gets their due or whoever stays on the list of a no winner, we're going to find out this fall, we're going to find out next fall. That's the thing about the Emmys, somebody always has to lose. This week's episode is brought to you by Warner Horizon Unscripted Television's smash hit Little Big Shots, from executive producer Steve Harvey and Ellen DeGeneres for NBC. Two of the biggest names in comedy team up to showcase some of the smallest talent in the world in this comedy variety series hosted by Harvey and featuring the world's most extraordinary kids. For your Emmy consideration in all categories. Pete and I go on talking about more topics related to television, which we love to talk about. We want to take you back in a little bit of TV history, a little bit of our own TV history, back to April and the Deadline's Contenders Emmys event that we had at the DGA Theater in Hollywood. We had, as I love to tell you, a load of panels from over 25 studios and networks. But two of them in particular we really thought were standouts for this week. One was Pete talking to The Late Late Show with James Corden's EP about what influences from British talk shows they brought over to America for Corden's new show and how they changed the format to create a winning formula.
Right out of the gate, it seemed like that show knew what it wanted to be. Talk shows take time to evolve. They take time to find their way. And this one, with him as a host, but also the format, which I noticed was different than most talk shows. So you bring all the guests out and they all sit on the couch together. That's right out of English, British TV. I've seen it done.
Yeah, that's something that definitely James and my partner Ben Winston were more familiar with growing up in England. But we decided to bring everybody out at once because it's very hard to change the format of these shows. They've sort of existed for a very long time, and we follow a format to a degree, but there's little twists that we could do, like bringing everybody out at once, that we thought would at least give a different dynamic to it. And it's made for some great moments. You play a little bit of matchmaking and how the guests, who's going to be on with who, and then sometimes the alchemy works out really well.
James Corden was born to do this. There's no question about it. He comes from television in Britain and Broadway, a Tony winner. Show was nominated for Emmy the very first year it could have been nominated here. What makes him the perfect host here, in your opinion?
He is just a, to borrow a baseball analogy, he's a five-tool player. He just has so many skills because he can dance, sing. He's an incredibly good actor. The two things that he hadn't done before, which were interview people and stand at a mark and tell a joke, which are the two biggest starting points for a talk show host, those were the things he had to learn. But he had all these other skills and sort of muscles that we get to stretch all the time on the show. If you went to a dinner party with James Corden, James Corden's going to be the guy that's making sure everybody's drinks topped off, making sure the conversation's flowing between everybody. And so putting him in a situation where he has two or three guests sitting next to him, that's an ideal setup for him. We try and kill him, and we can't. He just... We'll put him in the street doing Crosswalk the Musical. We'll put him in a car doing carpool karaoke. He'll have to come back from doing that into a sketch rehearsal, into a night rehearsal for a roll call with hosting a show in between. And he's just tireless. And so he is made for it. And he's also, he put in his 10,000 hours. That was one of the nice things about presenting him to America, is that for Americans, it was the first time you're ever seeing him, but in England, he was a household name. And so he brought his skill set from England here that was a revelation for the American audience, but everybody knew he was pretty special over there. When he was starting the show up, we wanted to come out of the gates firing as fast as we could, doing as much stuff as we could. So that's why... we had a super ambitious sketch in our first episode with Tom Hanks reliving all of his movies in 7.5 minutes. I think Carpool Karaoke came out in that first week. So we never really, it was still a day-to-day figuring out what the show is going to be. You start with that blank piece of paper at 9 a.m. in the morning, and you know that audience is going to be there at 5 p.m. But because James can do so many things, we just kept throwing more and more stuff into the show. And then we haven't been able to slow down since.
And the Carpool Karaoke now is, of course, infamous. And that, too, is like logistically looks like you're really doing that and you're driving and he's driving and it's all happening then.
And now, as Monty Python liked to say, for something completely different, I want to take you to listen to the panel that I did with the stars and creators of WGN America's Underground. When we talked about how in season two, they brought the legendary abolitionist Harriet Tubman to life on the small screen, particularly in an episode called Minty, where actress Aisha Hines performed, well, like it was theater on television.
One of the most exceptional, revolutionary episodes of TV. It's one of a kind, truly. Harriet Tubman, played by the beautiful, most talented, smart, loving, everything Aisha Hines, unfolds, peels every layer of Harriet Tubman's humanity.
What was that like for you? I mean, it's basically a one-woman show.
It is. It was a rich responsibility to take on. It was exciting, obviously, but also it was equally as daunting. The desire to certainly honor her legacy was way more important than my own fears and anxieties. And so over time, it was sort of easy to sort of begin to transcend what I felt were my challenges and just sort of surrender to her story. Because as you saw, Dominic, and as you alluded to, it's one that is so powerful and so necessary at this time. We're living in a country, you know, that was built on the backs of the enslaved and has sort of shaped the souls of our humanity. And so we need to sort of revisit Harriet Tubman and her story, that of her being a revolutionary, that of her being so courageous, so selfless to sort of take care of those who are outside of her scope. You know, I think that we would do well to sort of take a page out of her book and include many others outside of ourselves and outside of our families as we take care of this country.
And we shot it in 3 days, and she got the script a week and a half before and had 45 pages to learn.
Obviously, Harriet Tubman as a character in Underground is a big addition for season two. How has it changed the show for you guys as the creators?
It was our plan from day one to really start with these fictional characters you could see yourself in, and then kind of expand our world and add these historical characters. We had William Still, we added Frederick Douglass, and then the beauty, and I think what Aisha and Anthony brought to it, is Harriet Tubman as human being, Harriet Tubman as character who you understand in the long format of television, is someone who's just amazing. When you see what she's actually gone through, you kind of take her from Superman, you turn to Clark Kent, and then you understand why she's Superman again.
just for me personally to see and really explore and find out more things about Harriet Tubman, because she's so iconic, and to actually understand that we can all be Harriet Tubmans. And I think that is what writing about it, watching Aisha do it, and I go, oh, this was not, you know, first season we made up fictional people put together from real enslaved stories, but Harriet Tubman was out there actually doing the work, and I think it inspires me and all of us to do more.
But your character has really, really changed a lot. And so give us a sense of how the evolution of Cato is happening in season two and what to expect.
So Cato has, from season one, is at the end of the season, he's come into a lot of money. And has now traveled abroad and has learned, picked up a couple new tricks. And I think what we find out about this Cato is that he is more emotional. He's also changed physically, and money has changed him in a way that he feels that he's seeking that respect. He's seeking that ability to conquer, you know, to be now an individual. What does freedom look like on him? Cato is a person that has been on this fence. And I think he comes to terms with it in a way that people may accept and people who won't.
You know, you guys did, I know for season one, a tremendous amount of research to find the stories you found. What did you guys find as you went into doing research for season two? What did you find that surprised you?
History has always been tough, and I think we found with all of our characters, you can't just choose to be a hero and be a hero. The world, the way it was, you had to be a hero every day, and everything we found, the odds were stacked, and the people who did this were just more and more amazing with every detail.
This week's episode is brought to you by Warner Horizon Unscripted Television's smash hit Little Big Shots, from executive producer Steve Harvey and Ellen DeGeneres for NBC. Two of the biggest names in comedy team up to showcase some of the smallest talent in the world in this comedy variety series hosted by Harvey and featuring the world's most extraordinary kids. For your Emmy consideration in all categories.
All right, now we're going to talk about another Emmy category. This one I'm really excited about. I think this is one of the strongest competitive races I've ever seen here or in any category at the Emmys, and
I thought you were going to talk about NASCAR. I thought you were going
competitive. No, I'm talking about Best Actress in a Limited Series or Movie for Television. Now, Sarah Paulson took this award finally after losing many times in other categories for The People versus O.J. Simpson. She took it last year. This year, though,
Year is impossible.
It's impossible.
And impossible.
Let me tell you what you have. You have contenders against each other.
You have superpowers.
Yeah.
Like, not you have superpowers and then alternative universes versions of superpowers. Powers all showing up.
Oscar-winning actresses, at least four of the five nominees will have a Best Actress Oscar already.
And at least four of the nominees will have come from only two shows.
Yes. So
they're literally banging heads.
Yeah, Jessica Lange as Joan Crawford and Susan Sarandon as Betty Davis in the magnificent Ryan Murphy limited series feud. And then you have, of course, Reese Witherspoon and Nicole Kidman in an equally great show, Big Little Lies on HBO. I say, whoa, all of them have Best Actress Oscars. And look at who else might show up in this category. Another Oscar-winning actress, Diane Keaton for The Young Pope.
Another Oscar winner.
Nominee, Michelle Pfeiffer, who should have won for The Fabulous Baker Boys, but lost to Jessica Tandy. And that's because Jessica Tandy was in Driving Miss Daisy.
Still can't let that one go.
I can't let it go because I can't, because Michelle Pfeiffer, that was going to be her Oscar role.
Again, I come back to another theme of mine, stuck in the 90s. Pete Hammond.
Well, actually, in that one, I might be stuck even further back. I'm not sure. The Wizard of Lies, very good. They got the Bernie Madoff story.
With
De Niro, and you can't go wrong there. So we might have Michelle in the race. We might have Viola Davis, you know, who's big on TV now.
And Felicity Huffman, final season of American Crime.
Yeah.
And we have Oprah Winfrey.
Yes, don't count out Oprah for The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks.
And Carrie Coon for Fargo.
Yes, so, I mean, this is a tough
category. I think with this one, I mean, honestly, it's a tie. Give it to everyone. I mean, no, really, though. I mean, even besides the fact that it's impossible here to really break down anyone and say, well, that, I mean, for one, there's nobody there who you go, well, they don't deserve to be on that list.
No, they don't.
There's nobody. Nobody on those that contenders list. And honestly, we culled the list, and then we still got this. Secondly, you've got this thing where you've got so many exceptional performances, not good performances, not, wow, you really nailed a performance. It's exceptional excellence in action.
They're amazing. And, you know, I thought Nicole Kidman, my God, in Big Little Lies, if I had to vote for one just for the degree of difficulty and what she went through on that show, I'd have to say it might be hers.
Well, you also, but you know, you just did a long piece with Nicole Kidman when you were at Cannes. Yeah. And Nicole, who, I mean, if you want to talk about difficulty, I mean, this is a woman, what, four films at Cannes?
Yeah,
I mean, work. I'm going to work a little more.
Yeah.
You know, and both her and Reese were producers on this too, which I think really is telling of how they brought their heart to this adaptation.
Yeah.
You know, I can't disagree with you. I mean, but it comes down to is like, well, did you work that little bit more than that other? I mean, it's just such,
well,
such
it's,
a list.
Well, it's interesting. I have to pat myself on the back. When I was on the Board of Governors, they were actually talking actively about moving movies and limited series off the Emmy show and into its own thing. They were even suggesting selling it to HBO as a special, and because they wanted to focus on the things that the networks were interested in, which were the bread and butter series. And I kept saying, and I made a big argument in front of the board, and finally, you know, they decided not to do this, but it was a big battle. I said, this is the category. Look at this category year in and year out. It comes up with the biggest stars, the biggest names, and they're different every year. And you have this exciting race here, you know, and it makes the Emmys really watchable for me. It's not the same old names we see year after year on the Emmys in the same old roles. And I think this makes the Emmy broadcast more exciting, too, to have a race like this.
I think this makes the Emmy brand more exciting.
Yeah.
Much more exciting.
It does.
And look, also, I mean, it's an old chestnut now to talk about people, and we've talked about it, and other people have talked about movie stars coming to the small screen. But when you look at this particular category, you see how highly evolved, how highly selective, and how highly opportunistic, and I mean that in the best way, of well-selected, thought-out roles that these women have gotten for themselves. This is a tremendous category this year, and I honestly just don't know how you call it. I just don't know. I mean, what'll be interesting is to watch the campaign.
Yeah.
Because this is going to make the Republican primaries of 2015 and 16.
Yes.
There's no Donald Trump on there, but someone is going to have to break away.
And these great actresses are really showing that television is the place to be if you want a really good role. I mean, they're not finding them as much in movies. It's very hard to get movies off the ground and, you know, and in theaters. And
well, unless you
want to
play CIA, you know, Uber Lord so-and-so for Captain
America
16.
Well, yeah, look at what happened. What's her name? Patricia Arquette wins an Oscar, and then the next fall she's doing CSI whatever it is, you know, and
actually that didn't last that long,
you know, there you go.
That's CSI
even,
Cyber.
That's even worse. She wins an Oscar and then she does a CSI show that doesn't last. I mean
she was doing it before too.
Okay, well there you go.
Are you just you? I get it.
I'm just saying television
is providing these actresses great roles.
Yeah.
of our list is there anyone you think you could say, well, let's drop them off at this point?
I think the young Pope, Diane Keaton, I would drop off because she's not playing the young Pope. So it is what it is.
That would have been a very different show if Diane Keaton was playing the young Pope.
Yeah, but I just don't think, you know, whatever. I haven't seen the Viola Davis movie. I don't know how. This is one of those impossible situations where somebody's going to get screwed over. But I think when they vote, they'll vote for a few. The actors will vote for both of them. And I think on Big Little Lies, they'll vote for both Reese and Nicole. I think that's just going to be the mentality that goes in. I think those four are slam dunk nominations.
Yeah, I think so, too.
And so it's going to be the fifth slot that will be very interesting to see. I got my Emmy tapes. ABC sent American Crime. In the past years, they've sent the whole series. This time they just sent two episodes. I thought that was a big miss, and it was mixed in with all of the other shows. Maybe there's still a separate package to come from American Crime, but I think that hurts Felicity's chances.
Think Carrie Coon is another one. I mean, because of her work here on Fargo in this particular category, but also because of her work in the final third and final season, The Leftovers.
Yeah.
I think that she is going to be someone who is – she is going to be a very active campaigner,
yeah,
and she's going to be a very well promoted campaigner. And so I think that, you know, sort of like Ben Affleck in the year of Argo, which is I think at this point, if you're going to be opening an envelope in Hollywood, Carrie Coon's name is either going to be in it or she's going to be there helping.
And if the other two cancel each other out and Carrie Coon pulls off this victory, that would be pretty wild. But don't count out Oprah.
Never count out Oprah.
No, never count out Oprah. I would say Oprah is the fifth nominee.
Well, with that, thanks for listening to the Deadline Podcast TV Talk. You can find me on Twitter at Deadline Dominic.
You can find me on Twitter at Deadline Pete.
And of course, you can find all of our Emmy breaking news and all of the breaking news in Hollywood at Deadline.com.
Today's show was produced and edited by David Genove and Andrew Merrill.
Thanks for joining us. Talk to you later.